And really unique morning for us as we are focusing on something that I consider to officially be, I would say, like an epidemic both inside and outside of the church. And something, thanks, I appreciate it, Jamar. And so in this, what I find is this epidemic in the sense that something that impacts all of us. And whether it impacts us on a personal level, something we're going through ourselves, or something that a loved one really close to us is going through and processing, dealing with, or just someone who's in our sphere of influence, all of us are impacted by this thing. And that is anxiety and depression. This morning, if you were new at Vintage, first time, just recognize this is a unique morning for us. We're not always doing this. But this morning, I felt like coming even out of Easter, just in the world that we're living in, even looking at the news yesterday. Obviously, we all know what's going on with Israel and Iran, and we hear the Bible talks about wars and rumors of wars, and with that comes the nature of anxiety and the unknowns of what's going to happen. And people, because I don't know if you know this or not, but sometimes journalists exaggerate some things to get more likes and more looks and all that kind of stuff. And so they're like, the idea of World War III, and this is, oh my gosh, whatever it may be, right? We're like, oh my gosh, what's happening? And we find ourselves, whether we, this place of peace, and all of a sudden we're like, oh my gosh, what's happening? And all of a sudden we begin to see something stirring inside of us, like, what is happening? What's going on? And so in that this morning, I just see this as something that I want to talk about. I don't want to put a stigma attached to it, because the nature of anxiety and depression is that everyone's dealing with it in some form or fashion. We're all in a similar playing field here. And if it's something that you're wrestling with this morning, we want to talk about. If it's something that a loved one's wrestling with, we want you to become knowledgeable in it. And if it's something that a neighbor is dealing with, or a friend, or someone may be struggling with, then we want you to be able to be an asset to them, a voice, so someone who can come alongside of them and make them know, hey, you're okay. This is quote-unquote normal. There's so many of us who are struggling with this. And so this morning, I want to invite two good friends. We invite Christina and Tiffany to come up this morning. And so a lot of you, most all of you know, I'm going to switch seats, actually, and then hand off a microphone here in a second. But I think all of you probably know Tiffany. Tiffany is going to be to my right, and she is a part of Vintage and has been from the very, very beginning. We literally have pictures of her with her kids, and they're literally painting our space, 15 something years ago, right? We look exactly the same as we did then, really good looking. And so, no, but in that, right, like, we've been here the entire time. But so Tiffany is a clinical director for Sage Counseling in Kennesaw. She's a very gifted therapist. You may not know this or not, but for several years, she was actually on staff at Vintage as counselor and therapist. In fact, those were some of my most enjoyable years, because in pastoral counseling and therapy and professional counseling, the idea of just bouncing ideas off each other was super great for me, having her in kind of in-house with me. I really, really enjoyed that. And so super thankful for her as a friend and as a partner in ministry. This is our new friend, Christina. Christina Neria. She's here with her husband, Manny. Yeah, Jose. That's why I asked their pastor, Ernie, he's a great friend of mine. I said, what's Christina's husband's name? He goes, Jose. And just let it sit there, right? And then he said, just kidding, it's Manny. I'm like, you're a jerk. I don't like you, right? So anyways, it was really, really funny. So that's the joke. You're inside now to the joke. So she is also a clinical therapist. She's a director of Maverick Marriage Therapy, where she works, again, with couples, individuals, and families. She is a member, and they're both members of Sojourn Church, one of the churches in our network of churches. Yes, their pastor Ernie Wagner Jr., the third, one of my closest friends. Really important. He's one of my closest friends, and so we now consider her part of the Vintage family. So with that, you please give it up for both of them as they're here this morning. All right, little microphone change there. So thank you very much, and we are excited to have both of them. They are both married with children, and they have an active faith. And I'll say this because it's really important to recognize, and in therapy for them, they're not just counselors and therapists, but their faith defines everything about them, right? As people come in, that there are these moments of their relationship with Jesus leads this conversation. So as they're here today, I want you to know I have utmost respect for them, but I also feel honored to have them here today. But the third piece is this: I trust them. I wouldn't have invited them to be with us if I didn't have a level of trust, or high level of trust
the highest level of trust I can say with them today. And so as they're here, just know on my side, I'm excited and I feel very, what they're going to say this morning is something we can trust. So with that, I want to lay this out for y'all kind of as a starting point from Hebrews chapter 12. It's not on the screen, but it's a really, really familiar verse for all of you. And I'm going to say it, but I want you to hear it. And it's this. It says, therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, we just had the Hall of Faith. Chapter 11 is all the great men and women of God and their faith. And so this great cloud of witnesses, those who come before us, those who are the anchors of faith, those who are seemingly watching down on us and now watching down, have a great sense of wisdom and knowledge even about life. It says, since we have a great cloud of witnesses, let us also lay aside every weight. Let us lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely, and let us run with endurance the race that's set before us, looking to Jesus, the founder or the author and perfecter of our faith. So what I want to say this morning as we start, when we talk about this word weight, weight and sin are two distinct words here. They're not connected. It's weight over here, and on this side over here is going to be sin over here. We all recognize what sin is, willful disobedience, right? Willful disobedience, things that we are committing intentionally against God's will. We know it, we feel it, we see it, we make that choice. But the idea of weight comes from this Greek word that literally means something carried. As in the cargo of a ship, something carried. So the idea is like we can have weight in our life or weights that we're carrying that are not sin and they're impeding our movement forward. The idea of the ship is every ship has a limit of how much weight you can put on it, because if you put more on it, it would get it out of balance. It could tip. It may not float correctly, right? I'm a boat guy. I know if you keep on putting weight onto a boat in time, that boat will in time actually sink. The only way you keep it from sinking is by taking all the weight off of it, right, and beginning to put it back to its healthy place. And so what the writer of Hebrews is doing here, probably, honestly, maybe thinking about anxiety and depression, maybe not, I have no idea, Scripture's silent on what he's actually talking about here. But I look at our culture, our generation, and say, when I look at our young people, when I look at our Gen Z and millennials, when I look at our Gen Xers, which I am, and Tiffany, I was right, got my millennial over here, right? When we are talking about our generations, recognizing, man, we have weight that we're carrying in the area of anxiety and depression, and in my opinion, epidemic level, something that's never been experienced before. And you could go through all the reasons and demonize social media and demonize media in general, and maybe some of it's correct and accurate, but the reality is, rather than sit here and throw stones at something, let's look at those who are struggling, invest into them, and begin to talk about how we can come alongside and help them. Somebody take a deep breath, and then exhale, and recognize this morning, I'm not doing a Bible study for you this morning. I invite you to do your own Bible study this week, right? Go spend your own time with Jesus. Go listen to some podcasts if you want to. This morning's going to be a session where we're going to be pastoring. Not preaching, but pastoring. Coming alongside of those that are in need, those who are struggling, those who don't have answers, helping diagnose, help to throw some symptoms out there so you can begin to recognize, and then talk about some primary relationships that's maybe impacting, and specifically your relationship with Jesus. The idea for extra weight is this. It's meant to be carried. It's meant to be helped in carrying. Galatians chapter 6, verse 2 says, bear or carry one another's burdens, and so fulfill the law of Christ. The law of Christ is to love your neighbor as you love yourself. And so the idea in life is that if I'm a person who is struggling with anxiety and depression, and Tiffany's going to define it here in a second so you know exactly what I'm talking about. I think most of us intuitively have a grid for what we're talking about. But in this, it's meant to be carried. So the idea in that carrying is, yes, you are, listen, this is super important, you are to bring all of these things to Jesus in relationship with him. You are to submit them, spend time in prayer, spend time in the Word, focus on that and focus on Jesus, and pray and ask him to move in that area. That is always the way that we live life. But the nature of this is that we are then to bear one another's burdens, which means sometimes you bring your burdens, or maybe all the time you bring your burdens. You can't carry the weight. You can't carry yourself. It's too much and sinking you. You bring it to other people. And then bring it to other people. You can bring it to your friends. You can bring it to your loved ones. All of that's good and all of that's great. But if we're honest, our friends and family sometimes can only help carry certain weights so well because of a lack of understanding and knowledge. So many times, specifically in anxiety and depression, I look and say, hey, I'm going to come alongside of you. I'll help you in any way that I can. But the reality is I have professionals who have literally been raised up and trained in these areas to come alongside of you. And I would say, and this is important, in this, because there's so many, there's stigmas attached for some reason our culture around therapy and counseling. People think that it's weak, at least historically. Maybe I'm sure that's not you. I'm sure it's not your parents either. Maybe it is, right? But the reality is this, and I will just hear this. If all of a sudden Tiffany's arm falls off and she stops bleeding, some of you are going to start crying. It'll be super awkward and gross. I get it, right? But some of you start praying for her. You're going to go out to Jesus, and that's fantastic. Those of us, Christine, immediately going to try to help her. Scott, her husband's right here in the front, is going to come try to help her. You're all going to try to help, right? And then what are we going to do? We're going to go to a medical professional who can actually care for this because they've been trained to do so. So we pray and cry out to Jesus and pray for an arm to grow back. That'd be great. I've seen legs grow. I've never seen arms. Waiting for that one, right? Then we're going to get people around us to come and pray. They come to pray and like to help us. That'd be super great. And then we're going to go to a medical professional. Same thing with anxiety and depression. That we have those who have been trained and raised up. That's why I love Christian counselors and Christian therapists specifically, because they're carrying the Spirit of God, who is the great counselor, as well as their training in the profession to come alongside and care for both. And so in that, that's what we have this morning, right? The untrained, scary professional around anxiety and depression, Steve, right? I know a little bit. And then the professionals right here who can come alongside. I want to say to you, biblically speaking, that even just in modern day, I want to throw some names out for you of people who just, whether maybe have struggled with depression or who have for sure. A couple of things. Number one, we look historically at the Bible. Philippians, Paul says something along the lines that it would just be better, I could stay here, or it would just be better if I would go ahead and go to be with Jesus. Nice way of saying it would just be better if I would go ahead and die. Right? And I'm not going to sit there and say, so he's struggling with depression, but I will say I would be happy to make an argument that he was. Or if you go back and read any of the Psalms, like half of them, songs of lament. Talk about some guys who were struggling, both David himself, who was the king after the heart of God. Always see in Psalm 73, he says, I'm a brute beast before the Lord. All of life was oppressive to me and overwhelming. Right? I look at that, or I think about Charles Spurgeon. A lot of you know who Charles Spurgeon is. Just a great English pastor. Struggled with depression his entire life. Diagnosed. He talks about it in some of his writings. A lot of you Wesleyan people, John Wesley, his own wife, struggled with depression and anxiety until the day that she died. Think about more modern times. A lot of you have heard of Bethel Church, right? Brian Johnson, the worship leader, married to Jen Johnson. If you watch any Bethel music, he has this long teaching and a long testimony of his own struggle with suicidal ideation and depression. A lot of you have heard of Louis Giglio and Passion, the Passion Conference, right? He has a whole book devoted to his struggle with depression to the point he says, and there was a whole season, like a year and a half, I literally could not get out of bed. It took everything I had in me even to survive. So when we talk about this, we're not talking about, I just named giants, right? Giants of the faith. And they're struggling. The idea, it's anxiety, depression, is no respecter of persons or titles. And so this morning we're going to talk about that and recognize some of you are at these places yourself. And I want to, as we talk this morning, again, here's what I'm asking. One, be honest that this is something you're struggling with. Two, when I think about it, I always think about our children. I want to be aware of parenting. I want to be a sensitive dad who is aware of the struggles of my kid. I don't want to tell them just to pull their bootstraps up and do better, because that's painful and traumatizing for them so often. I want to get into their mess with them and walk them out of it to the best of my ability by the grace of God. And then I want to send them to someone who's better at it than I am. And so this morning I went to him, or friends, I'll be honest with you, the greatest thing that I can do as a believer to love my neighbors, my love myself, specifically my unbelieving neighbors often, is to pray for them, put them in relationship with you, and then direct them to a therapist who can help them professionally. Do all three. All right? So that's the invitation this morning. And with that, I want to turn it over to Tiffany Tufford, as she talks about kind of the diagnoses and symptoms. I do want to say, this is Sandy, just real quick, I'm going to do a Q&A at the very end of our time today. So there's going to be a phone number. I'm going to get my phone from my wife here in a second. If you can go put it on the screen for me, this is going to be the number that you're going to be texting your questions to. So along the way, if you have some questions that you want some answers to, I ask the questions, they provide the answers, right? In a bit, we'll do it in the last 15 minutes of our service this morning. So you can just go ahead and look at that number. Please put it into your phone, just a regular text. So put it there, take a picture of it, share it with your neighbors, right? I don't care. So with that, I want to turn it over to Tiffany, and we'll dive in this morning.
Okay. Thank you so much, Steve. And I just want to say thank you to you. I love having a pastor that is so pro mental health. It means a lot. So as Steve said, I'm going to talk more about anxious and depressive disorders. I'm going to talk about the symptoms, how we diagnose it, a little bit about what we think causes it, and most importantly, how they can be treated. For those of you who don't like the idea of calling them disorders and diagnosis, we get that a lot, right? I hate labels. Totally understand. We all believe that God created us perfectly to live in harmony with Him, right? But we live in a fallen world, and we struggle, and there is disorder. But I love that God is a God of order, and I believe that He does offer us an orderly way to get healing. And Jamar shared last week about how when God was taking the Israelites out, he could have taken them a shorter way, and he chose to take them by the long road. And that really spoke to me. And I feel like he does spontaneously heal, of course, but oftentimes he does take us on the long road. But he's with us on the road, and he's taking us to healing. So today I'm going to be sharing straight from the DSM-5, which that's the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual that we clinicians use to diagnose mental health disorders. You may hear that sometimes in TV and movies. They'll mention the DSM. So all this are straight facts. It comes from research. And I'm just going to break down. I'm going to start with anxiety, okay? And I want to, I'm mostly going to talk about generalized anxiety, but I wanted to mention social anxiety because it affects a lot. It affects a lot of people, but I love working with teens with social anxiety because I feel like I had it myself when I was a teen, and it would have helped me to have somebody to walk through it with me. So social anxiety is a marked fear of social situations where you feel like you're going to be exposed to scrutiny, or you might say the wrong thing, you might not have something to say. It's out of proportion to what the actual threat is. It has to last more than 6 months, and it has to cause significant distress, okay? So counseling, if you have a teen that you feel like struggles with that, or a child, or you yourself, counseling can really help change the trajectory of your life. Help you not live in a little box afraid of social situations, okay? I also wanted to quickly mention panic attacks, because 1 in 10 of us are going to have one at some time in our life. If you've ever had one, you'll never forget it. So these are rare in children. The median onset, which means average age of onset for a panic attack, is 20 to 24. It's an abrupt surge of intense fear. Okay, this is like a tiger's running toward you kind of fear. Okay, and it can start from a completely calm state, so it can come out of nowhere. We have a slide with the symptoms of panic attack. So this is what it can look like. You have to have 4 of these symptoms to be diagnosed. Okay, so palpitations, You might have sweating, trembling, or shaking. You might feel short of breath or feel like you're choking. You might have chest pain. A lot of people go to the ER thinking they're having a heart attack, and it turns out to be a panic attack. I would encourage you to still go, please, if you have chest pain, but they may tell you that it was panic. You might have abdominal distress, feel chills. Your body temperature may fluctuate. You may feel numbness or tingling anywhere in your body, and you may even feel like you're not in reality at the moment, or even like you yourself are not real. And lastly, you may feel like you're losing control or going crazy and fear that you're dying. The thing to remember with panic attacks is it will pass in minutes. You cannot die from it. You cannot go crazy. Most likely no one else notices but you. After you have a panic attack, it is more likely that you may have another one. And then if you have multiple, you get diagnosed with panic disorder. And if I wasn't going to mention this, but I was actually talking to Marty Altman, who's also a therapist that goes to Vintage. He's sitting over here, wave. And panic disorder can progress to agoraphobia, which is actually a fear of leaving your house. So you get so fearful that you're going to have another one that you don't want to go anywhere. And I just happened to be talking with Marty last week, and he said he's seen an uptick of this in his office. So I said, oh, I'm so glad you said that. I'm going to mention it. So if you've experienced that, call Marty. Okay. Next. Okay. So generalized anxiety. So women and adolescent girls are twice as likely as men and boys to have this, but men, I want you to hear, you do get it too, okay? Women most often will overlap with depressive disorders, and men most often, their anxiety overlaps with substance use disorders, okay? That means alcohol and drugs. Okay, so what are the criteria? Okay, so it's an excessive anxiety and worry about a variety of topics. You're worrying more often than not, okay, for at least 6 months. It's clearly excessive. It's very challenging to control your anxiety. And the anxiety and worry are accompanied by at least three of the following symptoms. Children only need one, okay? So adults need three. Children need one. Okay, so these are the symptoms. Feeling edginess or restlessness. You're getting tired more easily. You're more fatigued than usual. You have impaired concentration, or you're feeling like your mind's going blank. You may be more irritable. You may have increased muscle aches, and all of a sudden you're super sore. And difficulty sleeping. Difficulty sleeping, it could be you have more trouble falling asleep. You have more trouble staying asleep. Your sleep is just not satisfying. Sometimes, too, there can be stomach upset. Adults tend to worry more about their job performance. They worry about their health. They may worry about the health of family members, finances, typical life circumstances. Children tend to worry more about their performance socially, their grades. They may worry about catastrophic events. If you start to notice that your child is becoming overly perfectionistic and they redo tasks, if it's not perfect, they want to redo it, or they ask you for a lot of reassurance about things, let the light bulb go on that they might be struggling with anxiety, okay, and it might help to talk to someone. Okay, what causes this? Well, they don't exactly know. Part of it maybe is temperament that you're born with. You know, there are people that are just born risk takers that love to jump off cliffs. Other people are kind of prefer to avoid risk, and the avoiders of risk tend more toward this. There's probably a genetic component, we think. Okay, other interesting contributors, though. Reinforcement of avoidance. So, if your caregivers are, let's avoid this. It might be dangerous. Let's avoid that. The vast majority of learning, we remember, is observational. So what you're seeing your caregivers do is what you internalize. Significant childhood adversity may contribute. And don't shoot the messenger, but parental practices. Research clearly shows that overprotection or helicopter parenting and over control increases anxiety in kids. Okay? Generalized anxiety is associated with increased suicidal thoughts. It's the most frequent anxiety disorder diagnosed in suicides. Okay, so how can we combat it? Well, remember last week Jamar talked about we need to use our minds and we need to take action. So the best way to beat anxiety is with your own mind, beating it back. Sometimes medication is needed, but you can do a lot. And that's why I love helping people with anxiety. I'm sure you do too. One simple thing you can do, we teach people to do relaxation breathing. So I love 4-7-8 breathing, so we can just try it now. Just take a deep breath in for 4. Hold it for 7. Okay, and we're going to blow it out really slowly for 8. We're going to exhale longer than we inhaled. Okay, so it sounds so simple, but if you can remember to do that several times, it really works. Okay, there are other tools, progressive muscle relaxation. So your counselor can help you get all these tools in your toolbox to combat it. There are therapies that help. CBT can be helpful. EMDR, I have a passion for. I'm going to talk more about that in a minute. But there is help. Okay, we're going to move on now to major depressive disorder. So 18 to 29-year-olds have a 3-time higher rate than those over 60 for being diagnosed with this. And according to the DSM, in the U.S., starting in 2005 to 15, the rates increased more steeply for young people compared with adults. So when I read that and I was preparing for this, I thought, what happened around between 2005 and 15 that changed? I'm just going to leave that there. Okay, so how do we diagnose it? Okay, so you have to have we have a slide for this. You have to have 5 or more of these symptoms during the same 2-week period, and it has to be a change from how you previously functioned. Okay, so something has changed. So one of them is depressed mood, where you feel kind of sad, empty, or hopeless. And I want to point out, in children and teens, it's not sad. It's usually irritable or angry. Or you have a markedly diminished interest in or pleasure in things. You used to really enjoy things, and now you're like, I don't care. So you have to have one or the other of those. Okay, and then the others are changes in appetite or weight. You can have an increase or decrease, weight gain or weight loss. Changes in sleep, same changes I mentioned for anxiety, and psychomotor changes. What does that mean? Just think psycho is brain and motor, and your motor starts either revving too high, so you start pacing, you can't slow down your mind, or it slows way down. And this can be observable by others. Okay, you may feel more fatigued. I ask my clients if I start to suspect depression, like, do you feel like you're like walking through mud? Like even showering is hard. Yeah. Okay. Feelings of worthlessness, excessive or inappropriate guilt. You may start to like think about past things, think, oh, I was so terrible. Whenever I have somebody that come in my office and they start telling me how terrible they are, I always suspect depression. And start analyzing to see if it's present. Okay, you may have a diminished ability to concentrate, may feel indecisive. Even minor decisions become more difficult. And you can have recurrent thoughts of death or suicide. Very often, the thoughts aren't about committing suicide. They're just, it'd be easier, or just sort of like imagining it. But it can progress to thinking more seriously about suicide. And I just wanted to make a slide. I want to say go to the ER, call 911. And also we have a slide with a number that you can text and a number that you can call. You can just call 988. It's like 911 for suicide. You can call 988.
So everyone take a picture of this for the reason it's not for you. You can pass it to somebody else, right? So everyone take your phone out, take a picture of that, or commit to text it to the person next to you or your entire family. So let's press pause for a second. The Jeopardy theme song. I'm just kidding.
All right. Okay. Continue. Okay. So, what causes it? Well, there's no lab test yet to confirm. There's lots of research always being done. You have a 2 to 5-fold higher risk if you have a family member with depression. There's a higher risk for those who are single or those who are socially disconnected. If you have early childhood adversity, you have a higher risk. I wanted to mention women more often have the changes in sleep and appetite. Men more often have substance use and sometimes poor impulse control that will show up with their depression. Okay, what's the good news? Well, recovery begins within 3 months for 40% of people with depression. It's going to fully remit after several months, okay? The best treatment right now for depression is talk therapy combined with antidepressant medication. Don't be afraid of that word. If you go see a therapist, they will guide you through this process and get you with a doctor and help you through every step, okay? We love, love, love our clients. This is our passion. We don't think anyone's weak or we really, truly care. There are lots of therapies that help, CBT, I love EMDR. Remember the long road, okay? But God is with you. I asked Steve if I could say a quick word about PTSD because I do work with that a lot. People used to think it's, oh, soldiers get this. I see a lot of it. And 25% of people will develop it if they are exposed to a threat on their life or bodily injury, or they witness one, or their family member has one and they just hear about it. And it can really mimic the symptoms of anxiety and depression. You can have intrusive thoughts about it. You can feel like you're cut off from others. You can have that dark mood. You can feel hypervigilant and on edge. Someone walks up and you just jump. That's exaggerated startle. Okay, so that can be a symptom of PTSD. And you can have sleep and concentration problems. Undiagnosed PTSD can derail families, guys. It is so treatable. Want to encourage you, if you want to hear more about EMDR, which is the therapy that I love and do mostly, you can go to EMDRIA.org and read more about it. I'm going to turn it over now to Christina. She's going to talk more about how anxiety and depression affect families and relationships.
Thank you. That was so great, Tiff. Thank you so much. I love hearing some of the things. She did a great job. It's a lot of info, you know, and can feel kind of complex, and you just made it really easy to understand. Something that you said that I want to make mention of is if you notice, the treatment for anxiety is primarily talk therapy. However, the treatment for depression is talk therapy and medication. I think that's a really important distinction to make. We're not psychiatrists. We didn't probably pursue that profession for a reason. There's a lot of anti-anxiety medication out there that is driven by the pharma companies and can actually increase your symptoms and make it more destructive. So I just want to put that out there, that really talk therapy for anxiety can do wonders. You see great, great results there. Okay, so I don't know if we are landing this message yet, that like your anxiety, depression, or someone you care about, it's not a sin. This is not like this sinful thing that you've been punished and now you've got to carry this thing. And, Steve's point on weight and sin being really different, I think, is incredibly important. So if it's
thank
not,
you, Christina.
Yeah,
it was
so good. So good. Thank you, Hebrews and Steve. I'm going to say a little bit more, okay? And, like, if you're not there yet, you're not with me or us, it's okay. This is a message that has been given to us as Christians for centuries. Generation from generation to generation has given us the message that symptoms of anxiety and depression or any other mental disorder is sinful. Caused by our sin, we are being punished, we have to deal with this. And so I'm going to say a little bit more, and then I'm going to let the Holy Spirit do the rest. Okay, work within our hearts and our minds on this message. One of the things I really also loved about what Tiffany shared is the important connection of how these, right, we're talking about a mental challenge, right? It's an emotional issue, depression, anxiety. That's the first thing we think of is it's in our mind. However, as you notice, a lot of the symptoms are actually based on physical symptoms. So I think that's incredibly important. It really showcases how these symptoms are not always in our control, something we are creating in our bodies. Our bodies are reacting to it. Our sleep, our appetite, the fatigue, those cognitive challenges are incredibly important. One way I love to talk about anxiety and depression with my clients is that it's not actually a feeling. You know, there's like a feeling wheel. We've got sadness, madness, right? Like anxiety is not on there. Anxiety is not this feeling. It is actually your body's response to a feeling. It is energy in motion in your body, a constant level of fear and worry that is debilitating when it comes to anxiety. Depression, same thing. It's not just feeling down about a situation. It's a chronic physical and emotional pain that significantly impacts a person's ability to function in their daily life. The physical symptoms and cognitive challenges, like feeling foggy and tired, like you're walking through mud, that was great, you know, having difficulty concentrating, all of these things are really major clues to us as Christians that these are not sin-based, that someone struggling with such emotional and physical symptoms is likely also struggling to experience the presence of God. Things are foggy. They're not as connected. I really want that to hit home for you today. That's where I'm going to focus, okay? Research suggests those suffering from anxiety and depression, you know, it can cause them to see things in this almost like they've got murky, foggy glasses on, okay? Specifically, that situations are interpreted more negatively than maybe a partner standing next to them that's not suffering with anxiety and depression. So, an example, I wanted to kind of bring this to life for you. My husband, Manny, who's here today, if you have the pleasure to speak to him, consider yourself blessed. He's an incredible person, and I love him with my entire heart. Everything I've shared today about he and I, he's given me total permission. My sweet Manny. However, he's got ADHD, okay? So, like, that's his thing, that he, it's like one of the weights he's carrying, right? And he's working on it. It's genetic. He understands it. He can tend to be disorganized, although lately he's been doing an incredible job. So I want to give him major credit for that because I'm loving it. But, like, sometimes, for example, he's got readers, and I might, like, grab his readers for him, whether it's for me to use it or to hand it to him. And, guys, like, there's thumbprints and, like, smudges all over his readers, okay? The dude is not, like, very conscious. Think like mad scientist, right? He comes out of his office sometimes, and, you know, he's not cleaning his glasses, right? And so if I put those things on, it is rough. I am like, what's in front of me? It almost like it's disorienting. I like, take them off right away. It's foggy. I'm disconnected. I'm not able to see and experience my life clearly, okay? That's like what it is to have anxiety and depression sometimes. You're seeing things through this almost like information in your life. Experiences are going through this negative funnel. And what comes out is this negative experience, this negative perception. Okay? Looking through these glasses, right, you can imagine that because of that, again, they're not experiencing the presence of God. In worship today, I felt the Lord. I can very clearly remember a time in my life where I was depressed, some anxiety, mostly depressed, not feeling that same presence. So I really want to normalize that today. Again, another reason why this is not connected to sin. There is a cognitive thing happening in our minds and in our bodies when we can't experience the presence of God. Okay. The other thing I want to point out, and this is kind of my bend. This is how I work with people. I'm really direct. I love skill-based things. And so here's the reality. Us accusing ourselves, right, talking down about ourselves or our loved ones or someone we care about their symptoms of anxiety and depression and pointing to it as sin-based, guys, it's not working. You know, notice Tiffany didn't mention any research out there that, like, has demonstrated, you know, if we really come at this from the pulpit and we say that this is sin, right, people are being healed miraculously everywhere. It's an ineffective skill. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that there is not supernatural healing of anxiety and depression, because there is. I witness it every day in my office. I'm constantly in awe of God's work. And at the same time, it's not because I'm sitting there and I'm judging them from this sin-based perspective. Okay? So it's an ineffective skill. I'm wondering, right, if today you can really consider putting it down. Can we put that skill to bed? It's not working anymore. It's not serving you. It's not serving your family, your neighbors, the people that you are called to love and serve, that God has put in your sphere. So I'm just wondering, even if you've been given that message, it's subconsciously kind of in you, you're used to it, it's felt like some gospel truth, if maybe you could just consider it from logic, from skill today, that it's not working, it's not helping us. I really want us to put it to bed. Furthermore, I also want to really question, I want to go deeper into that part about how when we're in that negative perspective or someone's feeling really anxious, down, they're preoccupied with thoughts about their health, about their finances, that that person experiencing and recognizing the presence of God is just not what they're accustomed to. Talking to them about how it's sin-based is not going to make that go away. It's not going to suddenly click for them. The fogginess is there. The cognition is not working the way it normally was. Our bodies and our souls are intimately connected. And oftentimes in our faith especially, we're just really quick to over-spiritualize and spiritually bypass a physical and emotional problem. Incorporating our faith and our spirituality into our lives and looking at it through that context is so helpful. But with without additional emotional and spiritual knowledge, it can also be destructive. Okay, when we look at it from this lack of faith or God is punishing us, there are some serious impacts there, likely spurring person on to more symptoms of anxiety and depression, which I'm going to talk about in a moment. So it doesn't mean that folks with anxiety and depression aren't able to experience God's assuredness in their lives. And that's actually where we come in, right? So while those symptoms may be causing some element of self-deprecation, shame, which I'm going to talk about in a moment, it's our job as believers, as we're surrounded by the people that we are called to love, to demonstrate God's presence, to demonstrate Jesus even more to those who are suffering. Because remember, those foggy glasses are on. It's our job to almost like explicitly put it in their face, to love them the way Christ has loved us. The reason this truth is so important, and I'm going on and on about it, is because, you know, when we define symptoms of anxiety and depression through this lens as something we can control, it's this result of sin. When the symptoms do arise for a believer, for a non-believer, what ends up happening is they experience the emotion of shame. Okay, shame is kind of trendy right now. I'm not going to make the major distinction between toxic shame and all that stuff. I really just want to drive home that shame can be incredibly destructive. And it's actually at the basis of anxiety and depression. So, you know, maybe you're like, so what? You know, some argue that shame is the most destructive, the most challenging to overcome. In fact, shame also actually produces a physical experience. People report often like a felt kind of pit in their stomach, decreasing their ability to make eye contact, to connect with others. It's like there's this cloak of pain over them as they experience this shame. Shame is directly associated with increased symptoms of depression and anxiety. It's imperative for us to look at that emotion of shame. In a 2009 study conducted by the University of Ontario and the University of Toronto together, they looked specifically at shame's impact on depressive symptoms in adolescents. So Tiff did a great job of mentioning how depression and anxiety have a major hold on our teens. And a lot of what we can point to, what we're learning now, the research is coming out, and I urge you to go read about this, is its connection to technology. We're seeing increased numbers. The reason this is why Steve referred to this as an epidemic is actually because of what technology does to our brains. It's incredibly fascinating. I want to point you in that direction. So teens, they exhibit this greater shame proneness, right? Meaning they're more prone to these thoughts and feelings of shame. We also see that there seems to be a connection between shame proneness and anxiety disorders, such as social anxiety disorder and generalized anxiety disorder. So shame, we gotta talk about that. People confuse shame and guilt, so I'm gonna really make that clear for you today. Shame and guilt both happen when we transgress a moral, ethical, or religious norm, and then we criticize ourselves for it. The difference is that when we experience guilt, guilt can actually be incredibly motivating. We might think to ourselves, God, you know, Lord, I just acted and behaved in a way that was not really aligned with the values I have and who I think you're calling me to be. And that action I took was pretty awful, pretty terrible. And I feel pretty badly about how I behaved. And so that experience, they're able to look at the action as something that was negative. However, with shame, it's identity-based. As you heard Tiff mention earlier, they might think more thoughts like, I am terrible. I took that action, but I myself am ashamed of me. There's something wrong with me. I am terrible or I am bad. So when we feel guilt, guilt is actually really good. God created guilt for a reason. It actually spurs us on. It's this healthy remorse that says, gosh, we got to work on that. That's, you know, this character thing you've got going on, and I'm going to work with you on that and motivate you towards this positive direction and change. And that's where the Holy Spirit comes in. But shame can actually be so painful and debilitating that it affects one's sense of self, meaning who they believe they are at their core. It invokes what we call a self-defeating negative effect. Okay, so a self-defeating cycle of negative effect, right? What that means when I break that down is something happens, you experience shame, and as a result of that shame, you're actually more likely to then continue behaving in ways that increase your shame. Addiction is a great example of that. A quote I really love is that an addict needs shame like a man in the desert needs salt. It is the opposite of what's going to help us and spur us on to change. Research indicates that shame often leads to these three things. This is really important. Withdraw, right? You're getting away from others. Isolation, okay? Moving into this seclusion, away from connection, and hiding. All three of those behaviors and experiences associated with depression, anxiety, post-traumatic stress disorder, impaired empathy, among other negative outcomes. So here's the bottom line. I'm going to break this down for us. When we over-spiritualize or spiritually bypass depression or anxiety by blaming it on sin, some default within the person, we cause shame. We communicate in ways that increase the likelihood that someone already experiencing an incredibly great deal of shame will feel more shame and then continue to remain paralyzed in negative thoughts and feelings of anxiety and depression. And on top of it, remember, I said that these symptoms can dull the experience of the presence of God. So, man, they're working with shame, and God, they're not experiencing God coming into that shame. Such a lonely, painful experience. So shame is felt, symptoms develop, we blame sin, more shame develops, further isolation, and then they don't also feel as connected to the Lord as they're used to. The way I see it, as I break that down, is that because they are not feeling the presence of the Lord, we are that much more responsible as believers to be the hands and feet of Christ, to be loving, compassionate representation of the Spirit of God to those who are suffering so they have a better chance at feeling His presence. I'm going to let that sit for a minute. You know, ultimately, if we look at what our job is as believers, we can oftentimes approach it with grandiosity, this belief that, like, we know better or we are better, and so we try to fix it. I know I'm a recovering problem solver and fixer myself. I experienced family members and loved ones, friends in my life have depression and anxiety. It's part of what spurred me on into this field, and my initial reaction, just a human first consciousness response, was, I can fix it. I can help you. Here's what you got to do. And point out exactly what needs to happen. Problem solving is kind of what creates a wedge there between really being able to be the Spirit of God. Because the reality is, it's not our job to fix anybody. That's God's jurisdiction. It's between the Lord and the person to say, okay, what's happening within me? How do you want to work in me? What do you want to use about this, Jesus? Help me to get clearer seeing your face. And so if we can move away from the fixing, from the problem solving, from the pointing to sin, we can actually begin to see this person, right, whether that's yourself or someone in your sphere you're called to love, not as sinners, but begin to see them as Christ sees us, to joyfully delight in them, see their gifts, their humanness, without any judgment, and say, I love you. I'm coming in to this experience with you. I'm going to walk with you. I'm going to communicate with words of love and compassion and understanding. The Soul of Shame is a faith-based book. It's a great read. If you're looking for something, it's a wonderful read by Kurt Thompson. He does an incredible job at connecting biblical understanding of shame and its impact, as well as how to directly confront it with the Lord's presence. And he says this great quote, it's a direct quote, I'm going to read it to you here. In other words, we will be aware and know God. others and ourselves in the same manner as we experience God's awareness of us. There is no hint of shame in his gaze or in his voice. Our attention is drawn so irresistibly to him and how he is attending to us that we lose all awareness of shame that has for so long kept parts of us hiding in the dark. Toward that end, we need to pay attention to the things that are the summation of our lives, which are faith, hope, and love. To live faithfully is to trust him, to deeply attune to the presence of the Holy Spirit in whom we live and move and have our being. As we live faithfully, we actively imagine that he joyfully delights in being in our presence, and that all that we do with God, mindful that we live in dependence on him and each other. Congregation, Jesus is our hope. When we feel ashamed, we turn inward. We focus mainly on these emotions that are rolling within us, attend less to what's going on around us. It's self-defeating. It's also anti-relational. It's anti-Jesus. So the next time your teen is disengaged, worried constantly about their grades, their social interactions, their self-image, they're not making eye contact with you, they're distracted with their device, and you don't know what to do, I want you to approach with non-judgment. It's not your job to fix it, to control it. It's your job to get curious, to learn about what's happening inside of them, to demonstrate compassion. And hey, like, look within yourself and your own emotions. I know as a parent, when my daughter seems anxious, you know, she's almost six, I'm looking at myself and I'm saying, why did that just get me revved up? What was that? What was happening about her that sent me into a slight panic? And getting curious there instead of trying to fix and break down what's happening with her. We can approach like Christ with empathy, understanding, and our own vulnerability. Anxiety and depression are at the heart of many of our relationships today. They can especially impact marriage, which is what I'm really, really passionate. You heard some of the realities that Tiff talked about with depression and anxiety and suicide rate. Something I'm really passionate about is that working with males, men are grossly underdiagnosed with depression and anxiety, okay? The reason we know that is because you heard Tiff, right? The DSM gives us the exact data on statistics, and it shows that men are less diagnosed with anxiety and depression than women are. And you kind of heard her say, it's not because you don't have it, guys. It's because we live in a world where men are not allowed to ask for help. It is a major, major issue in our world. And so being able to see that connection, to be able to confront when depression or anxiety might be happening for you guys is so important. If you do that, and you do that for your families and your loved ones, you give the example and you pave the way. This is how we deal with this. We can be vulnerable. We can allow Christ in. I don't have to believe the world's lies that I've got to have it all figured out, and I can't be weak. The reason we know that it's grossly underdiagnosed, is because the male suicide rate is 3 times higher than women's. So it's not that they're not struggling with it. They're just not asking for help. So here's the deal. You know, when we are in that state of disconnection in relationship, especially in marriage, you're going to experience disconnection. Anxiety and depression are directly correlated with disconnection. If they're not intimacy inducers, okay? They're going to wall you off from your partner. There might be more irritability present. You might feel like you're walking a bit on eggshells. There might be this emotional distance, a lot of fatigue, a lot of napping, disconnected in that anxious and depressed state. So if there's any of that in your marriage, it is highly likely that one of you or both of you are experiencing symptoms of anxiety and depression. Your marriage is way, way too precious to let those symptoms just sit there. So I want to call you to action if that's for anybody here or anybody listening online. Again, path here, guess what? Again, recovering control addict. It's not to control it or fix it or manage it. Your job is not to change your partner and make them more like you or more like Christ. That's not your job. Your job is to approach with non-judgment, non-defensive listening. I want to break that down. That means when you're listening to your partner talk about how they feel or what they're experiencing, you're not also talking about what you feel and what you experience. You're postponing your perspective for just a moment to really sit with them in theirs. And then that makes the path toward empathy and understanding. And then again, your own vulnerability is where the progress is made. I'm going to share a little story, speaking of vulnerability. I'm a therapist that believes in appropriate self-disclosure. And so I'm going to put myself and my sweet husband out there for a minute to make this really relatable. Okay, I'm not sitting here, nor do I sit with my clients because I've never experienced these symptoms. The opposite is true. They're all too familiar to me. Almost about 6 years ago, I had our first daughter, and I was experiencing postpartum depression symptoms, and I had no idea that that's what was going on for me. I started to get a clue, right, because I'm this professional, and so in the midst of lack of sleep and foggy lenses, this cognitive kind of slowdown I was experiencing, I started to think, gosh, I wonder, is this baby blues? Is this what they talk to me about in the doctor's office? Is this what is happening to me? And it was terrifying. It was a really dark time. I was having a lot of intrusive thoughts and feelings that, frankly, scared me half to death. And I tried talking to my husband about it. And he would never say this now. No. He's so sweet, sweet Manny. But at that time, he said, "Depression is not of God, Christina." I mean, that was like a dagger. And so because I was depressed, I'm not wise and healthy like I am sitting on this chair with you today. I was not okay. I took that like a gospel truth and I ran with it. And shame ran my life for months and months before I said, I think I need to get some help. I think this thing isn't going away. I can't pray it away. I can't spiritualize it away, Manny. I need to get help. And so we did. I share that with you because I'm human, and so is my sweet husband. He's not a bad guy. He's the best you'll ever meet. He's one of the most empathetic people I've had the pleasure of knowing. But in that moment, in his humanness, he responded without any empathy. Now, we were able to get curious together about why that happened, right? We're in relationship recovery together. We don't fight like we used to. We don't have these challenges like we used to. And we're able to understand that when he saw someone who he perceived was really strong to not be okay, it scared him too. And he didn't know what to do with that fear. So after working together and being in couples counseling, right, we've since repaired that. We can talk about it so openly today, even though it was this incredibly painful place in our marriage. So I've only vulnerably share that with you today because you're not bad or wrong people if you've responded poorly to yourself or to loved ones who are experiencing these symptoms. You're just human. That's why we need him. That's why our dependence needs to be on him. In order to deal with these issues, we have to seek out the Lord. Vulnerability is incredibly important. When we become vulnerable, we invite others to be vulnerable. Vulnerability is directly associated with decreasing shame. In Genesis, we can see shame. That was the beginning of our story, how it caused Adam and Eve to hide their nakedness, caused them more towards sin. And we know the narrative shame tries to convince us of. It says, don't be vulnerable. Hide this. We don't want to show this. This is bad. You can't trust them, and you need to keep it inside. And that just perpetuates the negative thoughts that shame brings in, that there's something wrong with us, that we're rejected, unworthy, sinful, maybe even unlovable. Kurt Thompson says, healing shame requires our being vulnerable with other people in embodied actions. There is no other way to eradicate shame. Brené Brown, she's a big popular name. Some of you millennials have probably heard of her. She's done an incredible job on research about shame and vulnerability. She says, if we can share our story with someone who responds with empathy and understanding, then shame cannot survive. Vulnerability is the birthplace of love, belonging, joy, courage, empathy, and creativity. It is the source of our hope, empathy, accountability, and authenticity. We want greater clarity in our purpose or deeper, more meaningful spiritual lives, and so vulnerability is the path to get there. Y'all, God doesn't make any mistakes. He divinely designed our bodies and our minds The connection between shame and vulnerability is no accident. So I want to implore us to start using the tools he's given us today. To this God whom we meet in Jesus, we must direct our attention if we are to know the healing of our shame. We must literally look to Jesus in embodied ways in order to know how being loved in community brings shame to its knees and lifts us up into acts of goodness and beauty. Thanks for listening. Me share today.
So again, just recognizing all of us either are facing this personally, we have a loved one who is wrestling with this, or we have someone in their life that this is ruling and defining their lives. And we believe that kind of the whole point that we're getting at is that we get to be Jesus to them, just as we then also need to open ourselves up to let people be Jesus to us, right? And so to give ourselves grace and to move forward in all of this. Now,